Welcome to the Tate Talks podcast.
This podcast has been very kindly sponsored by JumpCloud for MSPs. JumpCloud for MSPs provides managed service providers a platform for delivering modern IT services that are identity-centric, cloud-native, and vendor-agnostic.
Hello and welcome to the final episode, can you believe it, of Season 3 of Tate Talks, where I had a good chat with Charlie Tomeo of Roost. Hope you enjoy. Hey, Charlie, thanks for joining us today on Tate Talks. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
No, it's been a while. I'm looking forward to catching up and hearing a little bit more about what you're up to now. So let's get going in the traditional time-honored manner by just saying, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. You know, certainly been in a channel space, you know, well over 20 years, been focused on MSP the past 10. And, with my longest stint being at Webroot, was at Axient for about 2.5 years, and then recently joined Roost as the CRO. So I've been on board a couple of months now.
Cool. And that's 20 years is sort of quite a long time to be doing this, right?
Yeah, it is. It's been, I have to say, it certainly has been learning for me, you know, over time. And that's the one thing I think about our space is that, constantly learning, not only just technology, but, meeting new people, learning, different ideas has always helped me, certainly be successful in this. And, I'd say MSP was the best thing that I ever ran into when it came to the channel. So it certainly has helped me in my career the past 10 years.
Yeah, fascinating. Because I was just before we spoke, editing another episode of this podcast that I did with Vicky Bruns from ConnectWise. I don't know if you know Vicky.
Yeah.
And we were talking about the same kind of thing, about sort of reminiscing about when I used to run an MSP and we were a Webroot partner back in the day, is you kind of had a really small set of tools that you needed to run these things. But the threats have changed and everything, and the cloud's changed everything. It's kind of running an MSP now is completely different to it was 10 years ago. It's almost like an unrecognizable business.
Yeah, it is interesting to see, but I love to see how quickly the MSPs have adapted, right, and evolved. When I first started my technical side of the career, I started as a system administrator working in a bank, many years ago, and seeing how slow you moved as a 70,000 person company with, plenty of resources to go do things. And then comparing that to the MSPs, it's just, as you guys would say, it's kind of like chalk and cheese comparison.
Yeah, that's very true, actually. I think one of the things that we've had to do, and the pandemic certainly accelerated that change as well, is that the MSP community has had to sort of think on its feet and sort of keep evolving.
Yeah, I agree. I think the one thing that I think we've all learned from the pandemic is that the acceleration of moving to cloud has, it's probably moved forward years compared to maybe what it would do, just because if you talk to most MSPs, they were working throughout. So and a lot of them that I've talked to were in the office, even though that wasn't supposed to be a thing or wasn't a thing, because they had to keep these small businesses up and running.
Yeah, it constantly amazes me how quickly the MSPs enabled this remote work for these hundreds and hundreds of thousands of companies around the world, where I think if someone had sat down to plan it, it probably would have said it would take like 5 years to do it, and they did it in a weekend pretty much. It's amazing.
Yeah, it definitely was. I'd say also seeing how quickly they move, but then how quickly vendors moved as well. Because even personally, when you look at it, all of a sudden now you're protecting devices that you weren't protecting before. In some cases, people didn't have, a laptop or something that they could use. So they're using home computers and just making sure that they were protected, that you weren't getting charged for double the licensing, things like that. I think, it was nice to see that the vendor community pitched in as soon as they could.
I 100% agree. I think it's something we can all be proud of. So looking back a little further then, I'm struggling to, you know, you're probably still in short trousers, but before you joined sort of the IT sales area, sort of whatever, what was your sort of pre-IT career background? How did you get into this space?
Yeah, for me, it went from, working in operations and then, it's really, you go back, it was, I saw people starting to do something very foreign at the time, which was, networking a printer. So all of a sudden we could all use a printer, and then recognizing that, hey, it's something pretty interesting, something that we certainly were at the bank, we're looking to move forward. So went back to school, got a networking degree, and then eventually moved over to the vendor side and as an SE. So I started as a pre-sales engineer and then managed those teams for a number of years, and then moved over to the channel. And, the first year in the channel was great. I think I was newly minted as the VP of channel sales at Webroot. Landed at Heathrow, and I looked up and I got a bunch of messages saying that somebody had posted that, I'm already failing at the channel. And I was like, oh, well, that's pretty interesting. I said, just took over weeks ago, and I'm already failing. So I think I'm doing well. But for me, it was kind of, learning, listening to partners once I took that on board, and figuring out what their pain points were and determining how we can move around those and help them.
Yeah. And do you think that your kind of technical background, the sort of networking side, and then the SE side of understanding has helped you within your sort of career going forward? Do you think that technical knowledge background is important or has been important for you?
Yeah, I definitely see it. Yeah. And I, you wind up, as you talk to people, you wind up finding that everyone's kind of been, a lot of the people that I know had somewhat of a similar path. And I think what it helps you do is it helps you look at things through the lens of somebody that, that's going to actually consume some of your products, right? Or manage your products. And so, my approach today is less of that, and it's been for years, less of that, pure sales and more of that solution type selling. So, making sure that, especially when you work for small vendors, just making sure that it's something that's the right fit for our partners and that they're going to be successful using it. And especially in the MSP space, they don't have budgets where they could just, basically sign up with a bunch of vendors and have stuff sitting on the shelves. If it's not something that they could save money or make money using, then we know it just never works.
Yeah, it's, I guess it's understanding the pain points. And again, going back to printing, it's, when I've been running an MSP and service desks and MSP, sometimes people see printer issues as kind of being low priority or kind of mundane tasks. But try saying that to the person that's got something that they're desperate to print. It's kind of the most frustrating thing that they do. And then also on the MSP side, when speaking with vendors, it can be billing is something that continually comes up, which a lot of vendors probably don't, they don't understand, a lot of sometimes don't understand the pain that the MSP has to go through each month to sort of reconcile this billing, because these horrible bills come out from some vendors. So it's kind of just not, it's looking at the problem from the person that's experiencing its point of view and just trying to have a little bit of empathy and try and make things better.
No, that's right. I mean, that's the one thing that we figured out early on was, MSPs buy, basically signing on for, an annual term that they're paying up front just doesn't work, right? They're putting money out of pocket. The other thing is not being able to just add licenses whenever they could. It was another thing that, there were a time where that was like a completely foreign thing. So if somebody was actually, onboarding a new new customer, if you're an MSP and you forgot to order licensing and it was a Saturday, there was nothing you can do, right? Because you had a set number of licenses that you could use. And so, you look at how we've evolved, as certainly as a vendor community is amazing. But a lot of that stuff was, even when we first introduced it back in the Webroot days, was stuff that we're kind of keeping on spreadsheets, and we're trying to figure out exactly how to manage it, because, if you look at most vendors, most vendors always looked at, two markets, right? Two go-to markets. It was either enterprise that they built products for, or they built it for consumer. And, you know, there wasn't like anything in the middle. There wasn't that, you know, mid-market SMB or even MSP model. So even that like multi-tenant and things that, you know, we look at today and we're like, yeah, that's table stakes, right? You know, if you don't have that, there was a time where it wasn't like that.
Well, I remember the time well, and endpoint protection. I remember we used to have to buy that on kind of 1, 2, or 3 year commits from, I'm not going to mention the vendor, but it was kind of, you kind of had to buy X number of licenses on a per client basis as well. They weren't aggregated at the MSP level. So you'd have to kind of go to each client every year and then say, I want to renew your antivirus or endpoint protection. And then have to have a sales conversation every year with them, which is obviously not great for an MSP. But I think that Webroot were kind of at the front of that, changing that to a sort of per user, per month sort of rolling thing, which made it a whole lot, and with the multi-tenancy, made it a whole lot easier for MSPs, and lots of other vendors have followed in all sorts of areas.
Yeah, it was, it was, you know, that I think is the big thing for vendors certainly getting started, and why you see more and more, you know, we see it every day. You go to LinkedIn, you go, you know, you can't hide from it. There's so many vendors popping up that are focused on MSP compared to the way it used to be. And, you know, a lot of it is that, you know, you're selling to the technical people first most of the time, right? You're not selling to the end customer. So as long as you, you know, the MSP sees value and it solves a pain point, then you have a good, you know, you have a good shot of being successful there, as opposed to, like you said, I remember the days of working with the VARs where, you know, you were going, you know, if you were lucky, you were going to each, you know, a handful of customers that they owned every month to try to convert them to something else. But it was constantly waiting for that annual agreement or multi-year. And then I had to ran into more of those 3-year agreements that it was like, oh, you know, what do you do? You know, you got to wait 3 years to get back in there. So it was, you know, it's just a different approach.
Yeah, it's amazing when you look back how much that's changed, but that was kind of the norm. And it's also, you're absolutely right that the software MSPs would probably find software because they'd heard it was good, or it's a good product. But a lot of the time they didn't have MSP offerings at all. It would be an enterprise offering that the MSP would have to try and sort of shoehorn into an MSP scenario until the vendors kind of caught on that, hey, there's a great opportunity. It's a big market. If we can tap into this MSP, or they probably weren't called that at the time, but this community of IT providers.
No, that's right. Yeah, it's always interesting to see, because it's just a different, you know, the way like you've seen it evolve with all these different groups that are out there. You know, the one thing that the MSP community does a great job of is sharing knowledge. So even competitors, I've been in a room with them sitting next to each other, and they have no problem with sharing what their approach is, what they're doing, how they're successful, because they believe in enough what they're doing that, you know, they're not as bothered by it.
No, it always amazes me that the openness of the community in the MSP space, where you say there could be competitors in the same cities or vendors, and everyone just gets together and sort of is honest and open feedback and tries to help each other, which is quite unique. So I guess on the, you know, following on from that a little, hopefully you can help some other MSPs and vendors. I mean, what are you seeing as the bigger challenges that they're seeing in 2023? This could be MSPs, vendors, or the kind of community as a whole.
You know, I think it's what we're all seeing. I mean, we certainly, unless you're living under a rock, you all know what happened with Silicon Valley Bank and some of the pressures on the economy that were already there to begin with, right? So I think they're going to run into some of those things, but we're still having a big problem with resources, you know, making sure, you know, hiring. I hear it from everybody. What are they going to do? And then I think the other thing is, one of the challenges we see a bit of, you know, there's a ton of acquisition still going on amongst the MSPs themselves, and understanding, truly where do you want to be from an MSP standpoint? And I'm sure you're seeing that as well, coming from an MSP is, you know, what's the future look like for you? And I think that's something that's been top of mind for a while, but it's certainly something that everyone's still talking about today.
Yeah, I think, you know, I've always been on the MSP sort of end game, I guess we could call that side. I've always been very mindful of the fact that a lot of these businesses were founded around about the time of sort of Small Business Server 2003 or something. And a lot of those people that built their businesses around that at that sort of time are probably at the age now where they're probably, or they are looking to exit out of it or find a way of sort of transitioning out of the MSP community. So I think there's going to be a huge continuation of the sort of either acquisitions and spaces or management buyouts or whatever it will be within that to sort of pass on that to the next generation. So I think that's going to continue. But I'm curious to know your thoughts about hiring you mentioned there, because it comes up on every podcast I do, every survey that CompTIA do or Datto do or ConnectWise or Kaseya or anyone. It's always seen as kind of the bigger challenge or the biggest challenge that MSPs have now. But so I guess the question is what can we do about it? Why is it so difficult to hire? Are we seen as an unattractive industry to join? Because we all love being here, but why can't we get the people into it?
I think it's just a tough thing because, you know, even, you know, we all know this, you know, vendors compete with MSPs for the talent that they've already, you know, cultivated, right? You know, we see it a lot. And I've seen it the last few years where, you know, you were definitely somebody that was, almost an anomaly at the time when you started working with vendors yourself, right? That wasn't a thing. Now, if you look at almost any of the big vendors, they have countless, you know, former, either they were MSP owners or the techies, and we see them, they're all, you know, on LinkedIn, and they're certainly providing a service. So now you're having that pressure, and, you know, as a vendor, you could certainly pay more. So, you know, that becomes a challenge. But I definitely think it's, you know, it's one of the reasons that, I recently shifted position is, you know, automation is definitely something that I think is going to be key for them in the success of, in the success of their business moving forward, because they can't just the economy to scale to have people doing these things when you can't have the resources is definitely going to be a challenge for them.
Yeah, and that leads us on to the next question very nicely, because I'm kind of excited to find out myself. So can you tell us just a little bit about what Roost do and what that and how that can help MSPs?
Yeah, so Roost is actually an RPA, so Robotics Processing Automation Platform. And, you know, really differentiate it is, you know, it's the difference between, you know, you talk to most MSPs, they've been doing some level of automation. A lot of that is built around PowerShell scripts. But, you know, up until now, they've been automating really tasks as opposed to processes. So we put them in a position where they don't really have to know how to code, but, you know, they educated on our platform, and they could actually take some of those processes that they have in place. And I'll give you, you know, two of the best examples is, you know, just onboarding and offboarding users, or the whole, you know, for the guys in the UK, more of it was a JML, right? So it's just making sure that, you know, you're taking the techies like manual processes out of the way. So we can do from end to end if you have a process built out, where it's just something that happens without anybody touching it. You could audit it. So it definitely gives them some of the advantages that I think with the traditional RPA platforms that are out there, which are enterprise focused, they couldn't afford to do, right? They couldn't afford to do it just from a, you know, monthly cost standpoint, but also the amount of training and everything that they need to get up to speed. So, you know, for us, it really is just, you know, giving them a platform that if they could think of a process, they should be able to automate it using our technology. And, you know, we already have, you know, well over 40 different integrations with the usual suspects in the MSP space. And we're going to continue that on just to make it easier.
Yeah. So it's always one of those things that it's a funny one, because I remember with RMMs when they started to come out and enable with Automation Manager and all these things, the first challenge would be you've got to think about what you can automate. I guess that's the first thing. You know, what are we going to try and do here? What is the problem we're trying to solve? And I guess you just say things like an onboarding, an offboarding, password resets, things that you can kind of do regularly that you think are repeatable, you can probably just find a way of automating, which seems like a great time saver. And I guess not only time saving, it increases the consistency and gets it done so things aren't missed.
You're spot on. So I think that's the one thing that, you know, when people look at it, they're like, well, you know, it's not too bad. We have it down to a science. But everybody I talk to, I'm like, well, how many help desk calls do you get because you forgot to put something on a system for a new employee, or you didn't give them access to something? And so overall, it's just the, you know, your end user's experience is far better. And the fact that you're able to audit it, you're able to look at the success of the automation. So there, if there is an issue, you can do it. And especially with the fact that, we are a, cloud-based industry, right? Everybody's going to the cloud. From the vendor side, but certainly from the MSP side. So it's just making sure that you're able to manage these things effectively.
Yeah. Oh, no, absolutely. The cloud, it is a cloud industry now. I was, again, chatting with someone else the other day about the changes that's happened in the last, again, the last 10 years, where RMMs were all effectively designed to manage on-premise devices and employer-owned devices and Windows devices. And it was all a much, I guess, a simpler world then, because they could control everything in the ecosystem, but that's just not the case anymore.
No, that's right. I mean, you look at, certainly top of mind here has been security over the last so many years, right? Everyone's talking about it, but, security is always easier when it's just brick and mortar, right? When everyone just, comes in every day, they use whatever machines you have there. Nobody leaves, you lock down firewalls, things like that. But things are just, businesses are too dynamic for us to live that way. I mean, I'm sure you remember the big buzzword for years, right? It was BYOD. Well, everybody, there's a case of, if you're a security person, you're like, yeah, that's a bad idea. Well, besides maybe government agencies, who doesn't let people bring their own devices into work? Everybody does. It's not just an MSP thing. It's a corporate, enterprise and the like. So it's, it's definitely one of those things where sometimes usability and, kind of success of the overall business or industry is going to trump the security aspect. So how do we adjust for that?
Yeah. And I think that touches a little bit on the hiring as well, because the BYOD or the choose your own device or pick your own device or whatever has changed things as well. Because it used to be, if you wanted email on the go, it had to be BlackBerry that would run through a sort of corporate BES server. And then if you wanted a laptop, it had to be this particular Toshiba or IBM, as they were at the time, kind of laptop. Sure. Whereas now people come into the work and they say, well, I'm more productive on a MacBook, or I want a Chromebook, or I use Linux, or I use Windows and I want to use an Android phone. And companies now, I guess, in this sort of competitive recruitment situation, are kind of, you've got to try and attract people by giving them access to the tools, with the flexibility of the working hours, but the flexibility of the tools that they want to use to get their job done as well, which makes it more of a headache for IT departments and MSPs.
You're spot on. I mean, that's exactly it. So it's, and that, a lot of the things that you're talking about are things that, are part of, the questioning during recruiting. I see it on the vendor side. People are asking for more quality of life things than, you would have seen. Certainly, back in our day when we started, you'd never think to ask any of these questions. And these are the things that are top of mind for people.
Yeah, no, it's changed massively. So a slight change of topic conversation then. So outside of work, what do you do to relax? What are your sort of go-to books, podcasts, if indeed you listen to them, or movies, TV? What do you do in your downtime?
Well, I podcasts a lot. It's a lot of what we'd expect, right? It's the people in the industry just keeping on top of it. Everyone from Gary Vee to yourself to Richard Tubb, and just trying to get a bit of an idea of kind of what are people talking about? What are other vendors experiencing? I'm also love gin. So I have a good gin collection here, certainly from my travels. So, been, especially over the pandemic, I've fine-tune my cocktail making skills, being we were home a lot, doing a lot of those, you know, virtual happy hours and such. You know, go to the beach a lot when the weather's a bit nicer. Last thing I've been doing is the Last of Us. I don't know if you've caught that at all. I'm sure you know what it is.
Yeah, I keep seeing it come up on the planner as kind of recommended to watch, but I've not sort of made the plunge yet. So I'll probably check it out if it's a recommendation.
Yeah, my kids kind of dragged me into it because they played the video game at one point. So definitely interesting. But yeah, you know, really a lot of it's, you know, downtime, spending time with family, with friends. And, you know, as far as, you know, the, you know, just things that I'm reading, you know, I got started on this. I don't know if you're familiar with Patrick Lencioni and the Table Group, but, you know, it's a lot of that, you know, it's basically, you know, just better ways to look at things. You know, he's got a few books out there, but recently read The Advantage. So it's a way for us to, as a company, put together our rally cry. Like, what are we as a company kind of, you know, what's our, you know, slogan of what we're charging towards, you know, this year. So I've been working through some of that and looking to implement that here. But it's kind of like, you know, OKRs or BHAG or some of these other things that I'm sure you've seen out there.
Yeah, I'll check that out. That sounds interesting. And I'll link to those in the description, which unfortunately means I'm going to have to link Richard Tubb as well, which is, you know, there you go. Free bit of publicity for Tubb Blog.
Well, he doesn't mind it.
No, I'm sure he doesn't. But going back to gin, it's interesting because I'm curious to know your thoughts on that from a sales and marketing perspective, because gin, certainly over here, and tonic as well to a certain extent, but gin's gone through this huge revival in recent years, in that they probably used to go to a local bar, like my local pub, there'd probably been two gins available, yeah. if not one. Now there's probably 20 or 30. It's kind of, how do you think that these gins, when they're fundamentally, I guess, a very similar product, are kind of being able to market themselves at much higher prices and generate these differentials in the market? I mean, how do you think they've managed to do that?
So I think the one thing is definitely, you know, packaging. You know, you see different bottles. You know, one of the ones that I got turned on to years ago, and I think it was at a party in Dublin, was Gunpowder Gin. So it's an Irish gin. And now I think they won Spirit of the Year this past year. And they've just blown up to where, you know, I'd bring it home when I came home from Dublin, and everyone's like, oh, what is that? And now all of a sudden they took off. I think the one thing that they've done differently as a whole, so it's given them an opportunity, is, you know, first off, if you're doing gin, turnaround time's easy, right? So it's not like a whiskey or where, you know, for you to be considered a whiskey, it has to be so many years. So you're waiting 3 to 5 years before you could actually sell something. This is something fairly easy. But the fact that a lot of them took it and they added botanicals that are a bit, you know, more pleasant to the non-gin drinker. They've opened up a completely different market, you know? So for me, you know, even growing up in the US, it was, you know, big Tanqueray, right? Tanqueray, Beefeater. Those were probably the big go-tos. Then, you know, Kendrick's kind of came on board, but that was really it. You know, you really wouldn't get, you know, too many more than that. But now it's just, I think it's that packaging. It's making sure that, you know, if you look at the bottles, look at the color of the gin. You know, could you imagine if I told you 10 years ago or so that, you know, there'd be pink gin and, you know, purple gin, and, you know, there's, everyone's got a different angle.
Yeah, it's absolutely. So, just from a personal investment point of view, what's next then? Because I keep hearing it's going to be rum, then I keep hearing it's going to be tequila, or is it going to come, is the gin bubble going to burst, and what's next?
Well, I think tequila is another one that, you know, if you grew up on the East Coast of US, like it was Jose Cuervo and that was it, right? You didn't really get anything else. But, you know, you start, and now it's obviously changed. But I remember, you know, 20 years ago going out to California and having like a dozen different options. And I'm like, well, this is unbelievable. Like now, whereas if I bought, you know, bottle of tequila, I could actually like sip it. I don't need to, I don't know if this was a thing by you, but you know, they put the salt on your, you know, the salt and the lime and, or the lemon and you kind of choke it down. And now it's something that's completely different. It's something that's great in cocktails and sipping. So I think it really depends on what you're into. I've always liked gin, even when it was just the basic, you know, G&T, but, you know, certainly having some other stuff out there, but I would definitely say, I've introduced a lot of people that wouldn't drink gin, you know, to gin just by giving them something that's a little bit softer on the palate.
Okay. Yeah. Good work. Getting more converts into the gin community. That's good. So, right. We're almost at time, but I've got a couple of quick questions. One of which would be, if you were starting your career again today, and I know you've obviously had a great career, but is there any advice that you would have given your younger self?
I probably would have taken more risks. You know, I think starting out as an SE and then managing the SE team, I was always reluctant to move into more of a pure sales role or channel sales role. And it was always the logic of, well, SEs, unless they do something really poorly, never get fired, but salespeople do. So it would definitely take more of a risk. And then I would also, certainly early on, is, you know, leverage your community. Like, I've learned more from people like yourself and just, you know, spending the time to talk to them and, you know, talk to people in the space and, most importantly, listen. I think there's times where we don't do a good enough job of listening. And that was the one thing that the MSP community taught me is, you know, listening to what they actually want and need. When I first took over the channel, it was like going into the bars who really weren't even doing a ton of business with you. And you know, it just wasn't this two-way agreement, right? It was more, here's the way you do it because we've always done it that way. And so listening to MSPs and them calling out, hey, here's why we don't like this. And most of them had a very good reason. So once you listened, it was like, wow, that makes complete sense to me. But I think, you know, breaking some of those norms, like you have to admit, like the one thing I found out early was the UK channel was, this is the way the UK channel is going to work. And that's it, whether you like it or not. And it's nothing where it used to be. And I'd say the MSPs drove most of that.
Yeah. And I think listening is such a key point. Going back to what we were talking earlier about things like billing or whatever, which, you know, MSPs can be quite, it's easy for vendors to dismiss that as just noise, but, you know, you've got to listen to MSPs to get that right, or you're not going to be successful.
Yeah, absolutely.
So final question then, and you've already given quite a few sort of tips. So I'm going to ask you for one more, if that's okay. We're speaking predominantly to MSPs on this podcast. And so is there a tip that you would give them to help them with their business, in any kind of tip at all?
You know, I would say, you know, just communicate, you know, make sure you're communicating well with your vendors, you know, asking for help when you need help. But as far as how they run their business, I mean, you know, you could probably give them more advice being at an MSP, running an MSP, but I just, you know, just keep on doing what they're doing. I mean, they definitely are, you know, certainly we knew they were the unsung heroes as part of, you know, what the lockdown was. But for me personally, it was a big change in my career working and focusing on MSPs.
Yeah, well, and that's a fascinating tip that I don't think anyone's given before, which is interesting, around MSPs communicating more with their vendors, speaking more with their vendors. And if there are things that they are unhappy with or things that they're looking for, then speak to the vendors. Because we know, as with a vendor hat on, we'd love to hear that kind of feedback or that kind of interaction. But I guess MSPs sometimes probably don't feel that they can offer that, or probably don't want to offer that. But so encouraging a stronger relationship, because we as an industry, we call this a partnership, right? So we call, you know, people, right, our clients that work with the partners. And if it's a partnership, it's got to work both ways in terms of, you know, we should be listening to each other.
That's 100% right. Every vendor needs, you know, the MSPs you know, just as much as the MSP needs them. So I'd say more actually, but you know what I mean? It's just one of those things. I've always had a very like open door policy with everybody because it's, like I said, you're constantly learning.
Yeah. And with that, I'm going to put with all of your contact details. So people may well be contacting you so you can learn more. Into the notes for this podcast. But thanks so much for joining me. I've really enjoyed catching up as ever. And hopefully we'll see you in the not too distant future, maybe for a gin and tonic or something.
That sounds like the first one's on me.
Don't worry, I will remember that. Speak to you soon.
Thanks, Chris. Bye-bye. Bye.
So there you have it. That's a wrap for season 3 of Tate Talks. Thanks so much for listening. I really genuinely appreciate it. Season 4 is already in the planning and we'll be with you very shortly. In the meantime, I'm off to have a gin and tonic. Goodbye.
This podcast has been very kindly sponsored by Jump Cloud for MSPs. Jump Cloud for MSPs provides managed service providers a platform for delivering modern IT services that are identity-centric, cloud-native, and vendor-agnostic. Using Jump Cloud's Open Directory platform, MSPs can iteratively replace point solutions by unifying device, identity, and access management. To learn more, please visit jumpcloud.com/MSP or email the team at partners@jumpcloud.com.